I decided yesterday was a bad deal. So, what you can do is you can drop a quiz. Well, we will grade these, and then you can write drop on one of these, or if you want to drop the one from yesterday, you can drop the one from yesterday. All right. Let's do number four first. Quiz number four. Ganglionic blocking drugs won't produce what? AV block. Okay, so number one is D. Okay. Number two, a large dose of acetylcholine would be expected to cause an increase in blood pressure after fully effective pretreatment with which one of the following agents? Okay. Most people guessed. Well, let's see. What do you want acetylcholine to do? Increase pressure. Right? So, how does acetylcholine raise or lower blood pressure? Let's do the simple one first. How can an IV dose of acetylcholine lower blood pressure? By binding muscarinic receptors in the end organ, the vascular smooth muscle. There's no parasympathetic innervation, so the whole parasympathetic side is kind of not a problem. So if there are direct acting muscarinic receptors, then acetylcholine will bind to those and you can decrease blood pressure. So one of the ways you would prevent a decrease would be to give atropine, right? Okay. Now, how can you increase blood pressure with acetylcholine? Increasing blood pressure. Let's talk direct action of drug on some system. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter in the ganglia, so you will enhance ganglionic transmission with a dose of acetylcholine. The dominant side in the blood vessels is the sympathetic, so you could increase blood pressure that way. There's a second way. The suspense is killing you. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter in the adrenal medulla, and what is it going to do? Stimulate the release of epinephrine. What's epinephrine going to do? Raise blood pressure, increase heart rate, cardiac output. So, acetylcholine can increase blood pressure two ways. Ganglionic transmission, activating the sympathetic side, enhancing the release of catecholamines from the adrenal medulla. But what has to be missing for that to happen? You can't be binding muscarinic receptors in the end organs, which will vasodilate. So if you want to increase blood pressure after a fully effective pretreatment with a blocker, in this case it would have to be atropine. Very tough question. How many people got it right? Wow, good for you. Okay. Okay. In the end organ, there are muscarinic receptors in the vascular smooth muscle. You activate the muscarinic receptor in the vascular smooth muscle, you get the release of this EDRF, endothelin relaxing factor, which is basically nitric oxide. It's a vasodilator. So you give a bolus injection of acetylcholine, you're going to have a direct action on the muscarinic receptors to vasodilate and decrease pressure. If you don't want to get a decrease in pressure, you got to block the muscarinic pathway. Why won't that be the case? What's the receptor in the ganglia? The N one. It's not an M one. Okay, so it's a nicotinic receptor, so the atropine doesn't block there. So ganglionic transmission will continue. Okay? Is that question clear? Okay, how do we make it clear? Bethanacol is a muscarinic agonist. Mivacurium is a neuromuscular blocker. Neostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Mecamelamine is a ganglionic blocker. Okay, so yeah, you got to recognize what the drugs are. So do I need to go through this again, or are we getting somewhere close? The problem is this is a very difficult question, and it requires cerebral function and not recognition. And I know that. Okay, does everybody understand this one? No. Okay, let's see. I'm going to really mess you up. Okay, if you look at the whole system, starting with the spinal cord, can you see this, Dan?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Over to the blood vessels. What's normally going on in terms of controlling blood pressure? If you just keep it a little bit simple, throw the heart away for a minute. If you have a sympathetic neuron, what's it going to do? You got acetylcholine in the neurotransmitter. It's going to bind to a nicotinic receptor in the ganglia, releasing norepinephrine. And there are both alpha-1 and beta receptors in the blood vessel walls. But what's the dominant response? Constriction. So let's just remove this so you don't have to think about it. In addition to that, in the adrenal medulla, the acetylcholine release is going to bind to this receptor again, ganglionic nicotinic receptor, and it's going to stimulate the release into the bloodstream of epi and norepi. And what are they going to do? They're going to come up and hit this too. The third side of the system is the parasympathetic side. Okay, now if you want to think about it this way, you can. Here's a parasympathetic neuron, but does it innervate the blood vessels? No. So this really doesn't have to be here. But if you were doing a different organ system, you'd have to include it. But this receptor is still here. Right? Everybody with me? The receptor's still in the end organ. So now what are you going to do? You're going to give acetylcholine. Intravenous injection. It's all in the bloodstream. It's all going to get to the blood vessels. What's going to happen? In the blood vessel itself, this acetylcholine can hit here. And if it does, you would expect then a decrease in blood pressure. It's a vasodilator. It's going to open up the vessels. Pressure should decrease. So acetylcholine will decrease blood pressure if you bind to a muscarinic receptor. Right? But that's not what we're trying to do. What are we trying to do? We want to get an increase in blood pressure. So how can you get an increase in blood pressure with acetylcholine? Well, you know that if you give acetylcholine, it can stimulate the sympathetic side of the system. Norepinephrine gets released, binds to an alpha receptor, constriction, blood pressure goes up. You also know that if you give acetylcholine, binding to, again, this ganglionic nicotinic receptor in the adrenal medulla, you release catecholamines, bind to the alpha receptor, vasoconstriction, blood pressure goes up. So if you want to absolutely ensure that acetylcholine is going to raise blood pressure, what do you have to remove from the system? You've got to get rid of this dilatory response. You do that by giving atropine. Now, is everybody with me? Okay. Very tough question. Used to be on the exam. Took it off. Everybody hated it. No one ever got it right. Oh. You might remember it now. Okay, so are we done with quiz four? All right, what about quiz five? Quiz five, which one of the following metabolic effects may be a consequence of the administration of adrenomimetic agents? E, hyperglycemia. So alpha agonist, increase blood sugar by what mechanism? Glycogenolysis.
Inhibition of insulin release.
Good. Beta agonists are going to increase gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis.
What exactly is that?
Increase uric acid in the bloodstream. Okay? Everybody, okay?
Before we answer this next question, how about, let's say someone gets 2, 2, 2, let's combine finish quiz into a 4.
Ooh, I look higher into that. Oh, that's
what I'm starting to quit.
Can we combine the quizzes? If we keep them one,
the two. Everyone missed it, it doesn't matter.
Number two. Which one of the following is not an indication for the use of dopamine? A. Yes, sir. That's true, which is going to reduce blood sugar. There are multiple effects. Okay. John. Oh. No, I was thinking of increased pulmonary resistance as a result of pulmonary congestion. So it's a vascular congestion. It's not pulmonary edema. It's not nasal bronchial congestion. Fair question. So low doses, you hit predominantly the renal system. A little bit more, and you get a cardiac effect. A little bit more, you get the vasopressor response.
So then the
cardiac's the beta.
Okay, so just slight increase in blood pressure.
Yeah, in fact, I think I have the doses. So just in case you're neurotic, the renal dose for dopamine is 1 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute. It'll improve renal blood flow because it hits the D1 receptor. Cardiac dose of dopamine is 5 to 10 micrograms per kilogram per minute. The dominant effect is through the beta receptor, so you get the positive inotropic effect. At 10 to 20 micrograms per minute per kilogram, you end up with the vasopressor response with the dominance of the alpha-mediated increase in peripheral resistance. There will not be doses on the exam. But just to give you an idea of how easy it is to titrate and to go from one dose to the other. Okay? I'm sorry? Just put the number on the top and pass them to the left. I'll just give you 2 4s. Okay, now, keep it quiet for a second. David has seen some ocular surgeries. He called his ophthalmologist connection, and he's got the rest of the story. Okay. So let's find out how drugs are used in ophthalmology. David.
The question yesterday was really bothering me because it was asking what you do before glaucoma surgery when you remove the lens. And it says you give a miotic, which didn't make any sense because that means the iris is closed and you're trying to get to the lens and basically suck it out through a closed lens. So they actually give you a mitriatic first. Open up the iris, bone up the corneal scleral junction, cut out the lens, put a fake lens in, then give you a miotic to hold the lens in place. So that's why that question was. And all the books seem to say you give a miotic first for glaucoma surgery, which is not right. If that made any sense.
Everybody clear? So I got to relearn some ophthalmology. For cataract surgery. Thank you. Okay. Clear as mud. Now, there's something else I was supposed to share with the class. It was emailed to me. Patty's buying your, well, I'm buying your lunch today, but. So why are you apologizing? Everybody benefits. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's your money. I mean, what's a pizza compared to your tuition? Okay, there was another, I don't remember what it is now. I only went through 100 this morning. Okay. I said we'd come back to this beast. First of all, in the handout, you can't read these words. Huh? Can you? Well, now you can definitely read them. Be- 37. So what's the effect if we do some, play some games here? If we denervate the nerve, okay, what happens? If you give a direct acting agent, with denervation you get an increased response. Why? What happens if you cut off nerve flow to a, an organ that's normally responsive? The nerve atrophies. What happens on the junctional membrane? Down here. The receptors do what? There's an increase in the number of receptors. So if you give a direct acting drug after denervation, you end up with an increased response because there are now more receptors in that end organ. Reserpine. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. Turns out reserpine depletes the neuron of neurotransmitter. So if there's no neurotransmitter around, even though the neuron's still alive, how's the post-junctional membrane going to respond? By increasing receptors. So you get a slight increase here as a result of turning on the receptors. Cocaine. What's cocaine do? Turns out cocaine is an inhibitor of the uptake system. If you're reading the literature, sometimes you'll see things referred to as uptake 1, which might imply that there's uptake 2. Uptake 2's in the end organ. But the same sort of thing applies, and that is the transporter is trying to remove neurotransmitter from the synaptic space. If, in fact, the transporter is inhibited, then the neurotransmitter's got the opportunity to do more stuff. So if you give a direct-acting agent whose action is terminated by reuptake, which epinephrine is, then the epinephrine's going to stay in the synaptic space longer and you'll end up with an increased response. Yes, sir? This is slightly increased. The rationale is there's a depletion of the neurotransmitter, so it's like having a dead nerve, and so the post-junctional side increases the synthesis of receptors. These are all increased. All increased. You're giving something in all three cases. You're giving epinephrine. You get an increased response after denervation and after reserpine treatment because there's an increase in the receptor pool. You get an increased response after cocaine because cocaine inhibits the primary mechanism for removing epi from the synaptic space. So the epi's around longer, it's able to bind more. Okay? So what reserpine is doing is basically wiping out your norepinephrine stores. If we talk about an indirect acting agent, though, the picture is different. Why is it reduced with tyramine? After denervation, there's no neurotransmitter around because the nerve has atrophied. The tyramine has to get into the neuron to displace neurotransmitter, and it's the neurotransmitter that's doing the work. So tyramine by itself is going to produce little action at the receptor. So if you've done something that reduces the amount of neurotransmitter, then you reduce the effects indirect acting drugs can have. So that's the explanation for both 1 and 2. Now with number 3, which is cocaine, what's happening there? You've inhibited the transporter. The tyramine is a substrate for that transporter. It can't get into the neuron. If it can't get into the neuron, it's not going to cause the release of neurotransmitter, and the response will be reduced. Okay? Wow. I can tell. Question. Tyramine is also a substrate for uptake, yes. All right. So when you've got multiple drugs in a patient, and those drugs can interact at the level of transport, you're going to have competition for reuptake. If it's a direct-acting agent, you're going to get a greater-than-expected response because there's more drug around. If the drug is an indirect-acting agent and has to get into the nerve to cause the release of neurotransmitter, so the neurotransmitter does the work, then you'll get a reduced response. And in this particular case, we're dealing with competition for transport, just simple competition. When you denervate, there are more receptors. If the tyramine can't get in, because in the in denervation, you don't have neurotransmitter. You denervate the nerve dies, there's no neurotransmitter there. So even if the nerve's still around and you got a little bit of uptake that can occur, the amount of norepinephrine that's available is reduced also. So with denervation, the nerve's basically dying. So that whole side of the system is going downhill. And if the drug has to use the nerve to produce its response because it needs the neurotransmitter, then it's not going to have its response. Tyramine causes the release of norepinephrine. Well, or it's not there at all. I mean, if the nerve begins to die back, all right? Now let's talk about adrenolytic drugs, sympatholytic agents, agents that act to block the effects of neurotransmitter or direct-acting drugs. Experimental setup in this particular figure is the same as before. You've got the alpha receptor shown here with arterial strips. You do a dose response curve to norepinephrine. There's where it would normally fall. If you add propranolol, the dose response curves are basically superimposable, maybe just a slight to the right. And why would that be the case? Propranolol, you know already. What is it? Okay. So is it going to have much of an impact in a system that's dominated by alphas? No. So it shouldn't change the dose response curve to the agonist a whole lot. And that's what you're seeing. Minimal change here. What about if you give phentolamine? Phentolamine is a reversible alpha-blocking drug. What happens? You get the parallel shift to the right. It takes a lot more norepinephrine to get the response that you're looking for. So with a competitive blocking drug, parallel shift to the right. What happens if you give a drug that is an irreversible blocker? So we could talk about phenoxybenzamine. Then you get a reduction in the curve, as shown here. Parallel shift, and then as all the spare receptors are used up, you begin to see a decrease in Emax. Okay. So we can use the same thinking as we go through a beta system. If you're looking at the beta systems, whether it's beta 1 or beta 2, what happens in the presence of phentolamine? If isoproterenol is the agonist, very little, because phentolamine has very little effects on the beta receptors. But if you add a beta blocker, propranolol, again, you got the parallel shift to the right. Okay? When we think about blocking drugs, what is going to influence their degree of action? It's the intrinsic level of activity that's going through that neuronal system. So if the system's in slow-mo and you throw a blocker on, it's not going to do much. If the system's in overdrive and you throw a blocker on, you're going to get a bigger effect. Okay? So just remember that. The next page shows, again, for those who love tables, something to memorize. For those who hate tables, yuck. There are words on a few other pages later. We've got alpha blockers, we've got beta blockers, and then we've got some combination alpha-beta blockers. The different drug names are here on the left. Mechanism of action is here. The one thing that's important at this stage is to recognize that there's only one non-competitive irreversible blocker, and that's phenoxybenzamine. And in the drug list that follows, that's highlighted. You can see clinical uses over here also. So let's go through some of these agents. Oh, before we do that, let's see. Some people use propranolol for stage fright. Why would it be helpful in stage fright? So it kind of calms you down. It has some sedative properties. It also decreases heart rate. So it can reduce a lot of things. Make you feel a little more comfortable. I used to have students give presentations in pharmacology, and I was shocked at the number of students who took propranolol before they'd stand up here in front of their classmates. Now, I will admit, this is a stressful position to be in, especially when you're nailing the guy with questions. But I was just a little surprised that, you know, even at your ages, that people would have that much of a hang-up to standing up in front of a group. In the third year, you're going to be nailed with questions all the time. You're going to have to think on your feet. And so, you know, maybe we need to work on that. Is that propranolol is not, no. Huh? Yeah, you can get a prescription for a low dose of propranolol for stage fright. No problem. Half the school of music is on it. Okay, Dan. Okay, let's see. One of the diseases that's on here, we should probably talk about a little bit. You'll notice that there's this thing called pheochromocytoma. Anybody know what it is? What is it? It's a catecholamine secreting a tumor. It actually can be found. It's of adrenal medullary origin, but the cells can be found in other sites. We had a medical student that had one, part of his bladder. He lost about half of his bladder. Took him a little bit to come back to full function, but he said he felt a whole lot better once it was cut out, instead of having the racing heart and everything else. So what did they do to treat pheochromocytoma? Typically, there's a mixture of drugs given, and the first one is, that started off is phenoxybenzamine. Okay, phenoxybenzamine is a long-acting alpha-blocking drug. It's irreversible. It kills the receptor. Has a half-life of 36 hours or so. And what you do is you put the patient on the alpha blocker and try to bring their blood pressure down to normal levels. So you're basically titrating the patient down to normal blood pressure levels. And then about a day and a half before surgery, you take them off the phenoxybenzamine and switch them to phentolamine. Now, why would you want to do that? Phentolamine has a shorter half-life. So the ultimate goal here is that the catecholamine-secreting tumor will be removed from the body at about the same time that your drugs wear off. And ideally then, the patient has had normal blood pressure for a while that's been drug-induced. You get rid of the tumor, get rid of the drug, and hopefully the blood pressure stays normal. So that's kind of a game that's played with these two alpha-blocking drugs. Sometimes the tumor is inoperable, and many patients are controlled very nicely on phenoxybenzamine for a long time. But again, what you're trying to do is bring that blood pressure down to normal level. When you think about it, though, you say, okay, but this is a catecholamine-secreting tumor. You're talking blood pressure. What about all the other things that catecholamines do? Sometimes it is necessary to give a beta blocker to prevent the beta side of the system from working. But most patients are well controlled on just alpha blockade alone. If you've got a patient that needs a beta blocker, you can choose a beta blocker, or you can actually try to put them on a combined alpha-beta blocking drug, carbidolol or labetalol. And in that situation, you're basically blocking the catecholamine receptors. And you want to adjust the dosage so that you bring the excess down into the normal reference values. So you want to see their heart rate at a reasonable level. You want to see their blood pressure at a reasonable level. You're not blocking the total system. Okay, you're just turning it down. So that's pheochromocytoma. It's an interesting disease. It accounts for about 1 to 3% of all patients with hypertension. And so it's actually one of the curable forms of hypertension if you can take the tumor out. We'll talk more about that later. All right, what else can I pull out of this table? Let's take a break. Pick up where we left off, please. There was a question that was raised, and I want to make sure that everyone's clear on this. When we were talking about cholinolytic drugs on page 19, listed a whole list of specific agents. Those are muscarinic receptor blockers. Page 19, muscarinic receptor blockers. They have minimal effects on the nicotinic receptor. Okay? All of them. Yeah, so just think of those as muscarinic receptor blockers. And when you look at the adverse effects, those, of course, are through the muscarinic receptor. When you look at the blockade that they do, those effects were all muscarinic receptor-mediated effects. So those agents really have limited action on the nicotinic receptor. Okay. If we think of specific drugs, we can kind of go through this table, or you can start looking at the notes that are written on page, I think, 41. We can talk about non-selective alpha receptor blockers. Phenoxybenzamine is the one. Remember, it's irreversible. Duration's about 36 hours, so it's a long-acting drug, 24, 36 hours. It has a little alpha 2 blocking abilities. So it's going to prevent presynaptic inhibition of norepinephrine release. So the net result is an increased release of neurotransmitter when the neuron is stimulated. One of the things that is a limiting effect of the drug that most patients need some time to adjust to is the very last effect, the postural hypotension. Typically, you would start with a lower dose and titrate the patient till you get their blood pressure where you want it. And thinking specifically now of pheochromocytoma. And warn the patient, don't get out of bed too rapidly, but sit up and then stand up, because you also lose the reflex. So postural hypotension is a limiting effect of the drug. With phentolamine, you got a quick onset, say 15, 30 minutes, durations on the order of 4 to 6 hours. So you can see that if you're trying to manipulate the system for surgery, switching from the long-acting drug to the shorter-acting drug and then basically titrating the patient becomes an easy thing to do. The nice thing about phentolamine is that it's short-acting. Biggest problem with it is the same as with phenoxybenzamine, and that's the postural hypotension.
On the notes, you have N, comma, B, hypertension. What does the N stand for?
Nausea and vomiting. And if there's a C by itself, it's constipation, and a D by itself, it's diarrhea. Okay. Under phentolamine, I say an increased CO, cardiac output, HR, heart rate. It says given parenterally, less effective PO, so that's orally. Yeah, I guess I'm pretty bad with abbreviations too, so it's the nature of the beast. Okay. One of the things that phentolamine is sometimes done, if you've got an IV line in with norepinephrine and you know some has leaked out into the tissue, you can actually give phentolamine to help prevent the intense vasoconstriction that could occur and help prevent the tissue necrosis that could occur. Not a big use, but it's possible. Yes, ma'am. Non-oral. So anything that we most commonly think of it as IV, just because that's the most common. Anything non-oral. Okay. Yes, sir. Well, if it knocks blood pressure down too far, then what happens? That's right. So reflex. On the next page, we had a student a couple years ago who was an EMT, and this is one of the calls that he was on. And it's kind of an interesting case. We got any EMTs in here? Okay. So you guys can translate all these abbreviations. So let's see. Who wants to read this? One of you EMTs read it. John, why don't you read it, and don't read what, you know, SOB is not what you think it is. It's shortness of breath. Where are you? Fever and chills.
Paramedics administered 200 vitals at 9:15, heart rate 140, atrial fibrillation with rapid or with something to make it a tachycardia.
Right. Rapid ventricular tach. Should have been our, anyway.
As well as a decrease in visual symptoms with no change in chest palpitation. The patient states that he has benign prostatic hypertension, which he was prescribed spironolactone and mild hypothyroidism. He also states he has had episodes of atrial fibrillation in the past, but he has not had one for several years. He does not believe that normally, upon presentation to the emergency department, the patient's vital signs were 135, that must be heart rate, 124, 72, respiration 20, and 97.5. No unusual physical findings noted. The patient's thyroid stimulating hormone level was elevated. The patient's blood pressure was stable. The patient was given metoprolol 25 milligrams per ozone. Approximately, his cardiac rhythm converted to sinus rhythm.
Yep.
The patient was discharged home with a prescription for metoprolol 25 milligrams by mouth twice a day, as well as instructions to follow up with disposition of the VA regarding dosage of tirazocin and monitor his thyroid stimulating hormone.
Thank you. So, lots of information here. What is tirazocin? It's a selective alpha-1 blocker. Okay, used a lot in the treatment of benign prostatic hypertrophy. Can be used as an antihypertensive. This patient's kind of unusual in the sense that he ended up having some major problems with it. But when you think about having an alpha blocker on board, what do you think, let's see, how do you think the alpha blocker caused this guy's cardiac problems? So what would be a major side effect of alpha blockade? Blood pressure can go down. If blood pressure goes down too far, what's the body going to do? Increase sympathetic drive to the vasculature as well as to the heart. So basically, the reflex system was saying, you know, heart, kick it in. And his heart kicked in way too far to the point where it wasn't functioning properly. Why was he so sensitive to the catecholamines? Because he was hypothyroid. So more than likely, you know, this guy was a VA patient. So, you know, at his age, he's probably not seeing the VA doc more than once a year. If it was a regular doctor, hopefully he would be seeing him more often than that. And he's probably just had a, you know, a change in the way his body deals with drugs, and now he's getting excessive responses. So they gave metoprolol, which is a beta blocker. Oh, that was another question somebody asked. You know, how do you make these drugs make sense? Beta blockers all end in O-L-O-L. So if you see a drug with O-L-O-L on the end, it's probably a beta blocker. If it's an A-L-O-L, or an ILOL, it's got combined alpha beta blocking properties. So that can help a little bit. So this guy was given a beta blocker to prevent the excessive sympathetic drive to the heart. What else could have been done though? And this is an important thing for you to remember. He was on a drug. A second drug was added to control problems with the first drug. Reduce the dose of the first drug and see if you still solve the problem the first drug was used for. At his age, if his prostate is really causing urination problems that are that bad, he's probably then qualifies for the Roto-Rooter procedure, transurethral, what's the rest of it? TURP. Anyway, Roto-Rooting the prostate. So, and he may in fact be able to come off the alpha blocker totally after that procedure. But we don't know what's going on in that regard. We don't know enough here. The other point is, they gave him another drug, enoxaparin. Enoxaparin, the brand name of that is Lovenox. Anybody know what Lovenox is? You probably will recognize it that way before you recognize the other name. Well, I guess I could leave you in suspense. It won't be on this exam. It'll be on the cardiovascular exam when we do the blood system. It's a blood thinner. Turns out that it binds to antithrombin 3 and it inhibits thrombin as well as alpha factor 10A action. All right, where else are we going? Let's see. So basically the ER doc said the way to solve this man's problem is to put him on a beta blocker and that'll take care of him. But what was the other thing the ER doc did? He said, go see your doctor. You know, and that's really important too. The trouble with an 82-year-old guy that's living at home alone is what? He doesn't have a nagging friend, spouse, significant other to make him follow up on it. And so that becomes a significant issue. Okay, no personal comments in the front row. So it's an interesting case. One in 10,000 may have this kind of exaggerated response. So with terazosin, doxazosin, trimazosin, there's a whole bunch of SINs that are alpha blockers. Yes, ma'am. Yes. You mess the thyroid levels up in either direction, you can mess it up. Yep. Okay, where are we? So, we can now go into the selective alpha-1 receptor antagonists. There they are. Look at that whole long grocery list. And you know what? That's not all. The prototype is the prazosin, or mini-press. Some people think terazosin is a better drug. That's because the sales rep did a good job. There's no real data to support that it's really any better. Except for its pharmacokinetic spectrum, it can be dosed once a day, whereas the prazosin has to go probably 3 times a day. If you're treating hypertension. If you're treating benign prostatic hypertrophy, you can get by with once-a-day therapy. All right, so there's a bunch of stuff down there. It's a selective alpha-1 agonist, so you don't have to worry about alpha-2s in this situation. Decreases vascular tone, venous return. Biggest problem is postural hypotension again. But it is great in combating the urinary retention with benign prostatic hypertrophy. There's also a combination drug out, prazosin plus alprostadil, which is a prostaglandin, for male erectile dysfunction. The idea here is the alpha blocker prevents or helps control premature ejaculations, whereas the prostaglandin is the vasodilator to facilitate erections. So these drugs have some very positive uses, but they're fairly limited in what they do. The last alpha blocker that we'll really talk about is called yohimbine. Yohimbine is more weird than interesting. It's a selective alpha 2 blocker. It has been marketed to treat impotence. One of the urologists in town says he uses it all the time because everybody that takes it has a placebo response to it. Whether or not it works, who knows? How does it function? It turns out that it enhances cholinergic drive, so that helps to increase dilation, so increases penile blood flow and erectile properties. It also increases adrenergic drive, so this stimulates then the ejaculatory response, contraction of the vas deferens, and so forth. So here's an interesting drug. There are some that say it's no better than a placebo, but it's here. All right. Those are your alpha blockers. Huge list, I know. But you can recognize the SINs are the selective alpha blockers. The OLOLs, as we'll see in a minute, are the beta blockers. Michael.
Why don't the SINs produce a marketed
reflex tachycardia? Great question. Why might that be? Great question. Why might that be? What might you think is going on? Why is it that in normal therapeutic doses, the alpha 1 receptor blockers don't produce marked reflex tachycardia relative to phentolamine or phenoxybenzamine? In normal therapeutic doses, the reduction in blood pressure is not so great as to kick the baroreceptors in gear to say, speed up. And this is one of the reasons why their use in hypertension is so limited, simply because it won't knock pressures down very far. But if you've got somebody that's just over the borderline and you want to give them something, or you've got somebody that's complaining of prostate problems, then it's a great drug for the prostate, and if it lowers their blood pressure a little bit, that's okay. They adapt to the postural hypotension in a couple of days usually. If you have to raise the dose, then you tell them watch it for a couple of days so they don't get dizzy. They're great drugs for urinary retention caused by benign prostatic hypertrophy. The effect on blood pressure is just a little.
So if you block alpha 1 and when you add the alpha 2 in there, that's enough to cause the reflex?
Well, no, it's going to...
It
increases both. The alpha 2 response probably accentuates, but it's not necessarily the cause. You don't get the decrease in blood pressure to the same degree. Okay? So it's a potency response issue. Yes, sir? Yohimbine. Cholinergic side is the vasodilator side. The adrenergic side is the contractile system. Okay, what about beta blockers? Well, we got a case history with a beta blocker. This is a long one. Who wants to read it? Somebody different. Go for it.
Glucose, epinephrine, and naloxone. Chest compressions, CPR, were begun. She failed to respond to treat her. She was then intubated and placed in an anti-shock garment adjusted to a pressure of 100 milligrams. Ringer's lactate solution was started. Over the next hour, she also received atropine, dopamine, and 5 milliliters of calcium chloride, all without effect. Diazepam boluses were given as needed to control intermittent seizure activity. 40 minutes later, an isoproterenol infusion was initiated. The pulse increased transiently to 80 beats per minute and systolic blood pressure to 60. These effects persisted for several minutes. At 15 minutes, she was lavaged. The return was clear and contained no tablet fragments. 100 grams of activated charcoal and 8 ounces of magnesium citrate solution were administered via the nasogastric tube. By 60 minutes, 2 hours post-ingestion, systolic blood pressure was 50 and pulse was 64 beats per minute. The patient was then given 2 milligrams glucagon. Within 4 minutes, blood pressure increased to 100 over 60. The anti-shock garment was removed. Glucagon was continued by infusion. Dopamine and isoproterenol were added. The patient remained comatose until about 10 hours when she awoke. Vital signs included blood pressure, 108 over 72, pulse 72 per minute. She was weaned from all treatment over the next 11 hours, at which time her vital signs were stabilized. Blood pressure was 110 over 70 and pulse 89. A routine toxicology examination on admission failed to detect any drug other than propranolol. Serum levels of propranolol were 2,640 nanograms per milliliter at 1.7 hour post-admission, 3,100 nanograms per milliliter per milliliter at 4 hours, and 1,657 nanograms per milliliter at 10 hours, and 1,240 nanograms per milliliter at 19 hours.
Thank you very much. So what do you see in this case that's kind of interesting? Okay. She started out okay and then went downhill. So what are some of the problems here? Well, first of all, she took a whopping dose of propranolol, so probably had suicidal intentions. It's not uncommon in about 60% of the patients that take over 1,600 milligrams of propranolol to have seizures. So this is what she showed. And so her heart rate was kind of okay at that point. She then had these seizures, each lasting 20 to 30 seconds, and then her blood pressure bottomed out. Pulse went way down, da-da-da. Then they threw everything they had at her. They gave her some oxygen, sodium bicarb, glucose, epi, naloxone. Why were all those things given? So to jump the heart, to get things back up to kind of a more normal level, to reduce hypoglycemic problems. That's why the glucose would have been given. At the time, they didn't know that there was no other drug on board, so if you give naloxone, it turns out naloxone is an antagonist of opioids. So if you're thinking she could be on opiates, then you could give naloxone. One of the problems that runs, I shouldn't say problems, one of the pieces of information that would suggest that opiates are not the problem is the fact that in typical opiate toxicity, you have pinpoint pupils, and hers were dilated. So if she's anoxic enough, then she would be dilated, but normally with opiate poisoning, you're pinpoint pupils. Let's see, where else? They did CPR, then they hit her with anti-shock garments, and then they gave her atropine. Atropine is going to... Why would they give atropine here? Okay, so blocking parasympathetic drive, so hopefully that'll speed some things up. Dopamine. This is a cardiac dose that was raised to a pressor dose. So they really want to try to get the heart going and increase the blood pressure. Gave some calcium chloride also. The diazepam was used to control seizures. That's very common. Then they started an isoproterenol infusion. You got a competitive blocker, so giving a competitive agonist might seem like a rational, reasonable thing to do. The bottom line is that they got her stabilized to the point where they felt they could do some lavage. Why did they give her magnesium citrate? Huh? Push things along, yes. Activated charcoal should bind things up in the gut. Once the charcoal stool passes, you would probably assume that any drug that's in the gut would have passed out as well. So it gives you a marker for intestinal transit. And then we got more changes here. Okay. Then they also gave her some glucagon. Glucagon is a positive inotrope. So again, it's trying to improve conduction and increase force of contraction in the heart. It turns out it augments cyclic AMP through a glucagon receptor. All right, what else we got in here? All right. So with beta blockers, what's typical? Cardiac arrhythmias can be of any kind. Heart rate typically drops. AV block is common. Blood pressure drops. If the blood pressure drop is significant, what would you expect to see with blood pressure and heart rate? They'll try to go back in the other direction. So you kind of get a mixed bag of effects depending on the individual patient. So it's not always clean. Yes, sir?
What kind of dose of dopamine do you give the adequate?
What kind of dose?
Earlier the dopamine was the cardiac dose, 3 is the pressure dose, and so you added it again after the glucagon.
I don't know what the dose was. I would assume it was the same dose, but I don't know. Yes, sir? Why would you give calcium? Increase contractility, and it helps control arrhythmias. Sometimes they'll give magnesium instead. Okay. So lots of things going on. So beta blocker overdose, fairly, unfortunately, common. It's easily treatable. I should rephrase that. It's treatable with success, but if you're in the ER, you're going to work to keep the patient going. But to lose a patient on a beta blocker usually is because something else is on board. You can support vitals and keep them going. When we think of beta blockers as a class, I'm going to show you this nasty table, which is on the next page. But really, a beta blocker is a beta blocker is a beta blocker. That's what most of the clinicians say. So why would you choose one beta blocker over another? Well, there are some theoretical bases for making decisions, and they're kind of shown here. If you're really looking for effects on the heart, and you're trying to spare other tissues, then it might be best to have beta 1 selectivity. So you've decided this patient needs a beta blocker. Let's say they have angina, and you've decided to put them on a beta blocker, but they've also got asthma. Which beta blocker might you choose? It might be more rational to choose a beta 1 selective over a non-selective to spare the beta 2 receptors. Sometimes you may have a patient that has arrhythmias. Well, beta blockers can be used as antiarrhythmic drugs, and so what property might be used to control an arrhythmia? You might choose an agent that has this so-called local anesthetic property. It's a membrane stabilizing property. So sometimes in some books it's abbreviated MSA, membrane stabilizing action. And so you can see that there are some, acebutolol for one, labetalol, metoprolol, propranolol, have this membrane stabilizing action. And when we talk about antiarrhythmics, those are the main ones that you see being used. The other thing that sometimes happens is this partial agonist action. In theory, this is also a property to take advantage of in asthmatics, because these drugs, turns out, are beta-1 blockers, and in typical doses that are used clinically, they're partial agonists to the beta-2 receptor. So if you need that beta-2 response to occur, then a drug that can be a partial agonist at that site kind of makes sense. You're giving them a beta blocker for some other problem, okay? But they already have a concurrent disease, pulmonary. And you don't want to compromise beta-2 dilation of the bronchial smooth muscle. So you're going to choose your beta blocker, and you want to choose one that has this partial agonist property, because theoretically it would be better than one that doesn't. So when you read the beta blocker literature, you'll see discussions of partial agonists toward the beta-2 receptor as a property. You'll see membrane stabilizing or this local anesthetic effect as a property. And you'll see discussions of beta-1 selectivity as a property. And so there are things that distinguish these drugs. The other thing that distinguishes these drugs would be things like elimination half-life as well as approximate bioavailability. As you can see, bioavailability can go from basically fully available to very limited availability. So if we think of propranolol at 30%, pendolol at greater than 90%, you've got a big difference there. Well, obviously, when you look at the dosing packages, they're packaged in the right amount to overcome that kind of an issue. But it is there. The elimination half-life is another property that you have to be careful with. Propranolol is a good example. 3.5 to 6 hours, the chart says. But propranolol is oxidized to 4-hydroxypropranolol, which has a half-life of 14 hours. 4-hydroxypropranolol is active. So you need to know if it's an active metabolite or not. You need to look at really the full biological half-life. So sometimes you got to be careful when a rep comes in and they start talking half-lives. Make sure you know what they're talking about. But that's probably the biggest difference in this class of drugs. Notice that something like esmolol is very short-acting, about 10 minutes. Esmolol gets a terrific amount of use controlling cardiac arrhythmias in the operating room. People on anesthetics often have arrhythmias. You can give the short-acting beta blocker, control it, and you're great and good to go. And it wears off very, very quickly. And then you've got other drugs with much longer half-lives, the longest being butaxolol or nalidol. One of the other things that you get into having to think about are potencies. Some people like to compare propranolol to temolol. Temolol is 10 times more potent. Potency becomes important because let's say a patient's been on propranolol as an antihypertensive. They've been well controlled for years. Propranolol, it turns out, also causes CNS suppression or depression, sedation. So it has sedative and depressive properties. So let's say you've got a patient, they've been well controlled on a beta blocker for their blood pressure, and all of a sudden they're having depression. Could it be drug induced? Possibly. Could it be drug exacerbated? Probably. So do they need an antidepressant? Better to say, wait a minute. We got a drug that we know that can be causing problems, so let's switch them. Let's go to another beta blocker. This happened to a friend of mine. She was switched from propranolol to nadolol. She was taking aerobics at the Y. She couldn't even function. What happened? The dosage wasn't adjusted properly. So she went from 300 milligrams of propranolol to about 150 milligrams of nadolol. My comment to her was, I said, hey, take your blood pressure, take your pulse rate when you're trying to exercise, keep a chart, call your doc. First thing that happened, dose was cut in half. 2 weeks later, they cut her again. But nadolol is about five times more potent. So just as an a priori starting point, you could have cut the dose, you know, by five and see what happened. Nadolol does not seem to produce as much CNS depression or sedation as propranolol. So there are some differences within the group that can be taken to advantage when circumstances require you to get picky and pull out the book and look at all these special properties. Okay, enough soapboxing. Let's see, what else do we have here? With the beta blockers, we're going to spend a fair amount of time later talking about how they reduce blood pressure. The reduction in blood pressure is rather complex. It involves about four different steps. One is it decreases cardiac output. That kind of makes sense. It decreases renin release. So now you get a little bit of relief from the angiotensin system. It decreases peripheral sympathetic outflow. So it has some central properties that can facilitate decreases. And it also prevents presynaptic beta 2 mediated facilitation of neurotransmitter release. So there are, I'll repeat them. So there's four mechanisms by which these drugs can reduce blood pressure. Direct action on cardiac function, so decrease in cardiac output. You can decrease renin release. You can decrease peripheral sympathetic drive to the vasculature and the heart. So this is a central mediated effect. And there are presynaptic beta 2 receptors which would normally function to increase neurotransmitter release, but now if you block them, you block that facilitated release. So it prevents presynaptic beta 2 mediated facilitation of norepinephrine release. Okay. There are some specific things that I've listed on page 44 under the chart to just pull out four agents. I chose those four just because they have major differences in their spectrums. But really, when you're practicing, you're going to think beta blockers or beta blockers. And only until something weird happens do you start getting picky with them. Okay. Oh, I know we skipped this part. What are beta blockers useful for? We've talked about antihypertensive effects. I mentioned antiarrhythmic properties. I talked about angina. So they can be anti-anginal agents. We talked about stage fright. Let's see, that's 4. Beta blockers are useful in the treatment of glaucoma. Antihypertensive, antianginal, antiarrhythmic. I'm missing one. Migraines. And you can use it as an adjunct to alpha blockade in pheochromocytoma. Lots of uses then for beta blockers. Antihypertensive, antiarrhythmic, antianginal, stage fright, anxiety states, if you will, glaucoma, migraine, pheochromocytoma. Okay. If you turn over a couple pages, we have the other sympatholytic drugs. The top two on the list are labetalol and carbidolol. Notice that the first of the suffix is something other than an O. So that indicates that it's got alpha-blocking properties as well. So they're beta blockers. They're somewhat selective as alpha-1 blockers. They're partial agonists to beta-2 receptors. And so they've got a number of properties associated with them. So labetalol and carbidolol. One of the paradoxical uses of beta blockers, and specifically carbidolol was in the studies, it's used in moderate congestive heart failure. Now I see some frowns. That's good. One of the side effects of beta blockers is you can induce heart failure. So how in the world, or why in the world, would you want to use a beta blocker in congestive heart failure? It turns out that the heart basically changes shape with heart failure. You notice that it normally comes down to a nice pointed apex, and the chambers then have great evacuation potential, the ventricular chambers, because of the way they come down to that little point, and they can easily squeeze out through the valves, thank you. Okay, the cardiac remodeling occurs when the heart goes from that pointy shape to a round bottom, and then you don't get complete evacuation of the ventricles. Beta blockers prevent that remodeling. And so in some patients, that becomes an important therapeutic desire. Carbidolol was the one that was done in the studies. Many patients respond very well. We'll talk about congestive heart failure again later, but it is a paradoxical use for these drugs. Okay. Yes, Sean. Yes. No. It will block the beta 2s, but it has this partial active, it's dose related, and at the typical use dose, it will have some agonist properties across the beta 2 receptor. Okay. The next three drugs are the weird ones. Okay? These drugs have been around forever and ever. They were used quite a bit experimentally to try to understand the system. The thing that makes them limited in their use is they've got some nasty side effects associated with them. If we look first at guanethidine, and really Guanadrel is the same. These guys enter by neuronal uptake. They displace norepinephrine in the synaptic vesicle. So initially, When you start dosing, you get a release of neurotransmitter and you get the responses you'd expect from more neurotransmitter. But since the neurotransmitter is released now, it gets chewed up by MAO, COMT, so eventually the neuron has a lesser level of neurotransmitter in it. So chronic therapy depletes or reduces norepinephrine stores. If you've got somebody with severe hypertension, nothing else is working, and you want to throw a real lowering drug on board, you can throw guanethidine into the system. It's typically fourth line drug, but it is great in severe hypertension and bringing blood pressure down. Biggest problem with it is postural hypotension. Numerous drug actions and interactions. So there's a limitation to that. And it's contraindicated in pheochromocytoma simply because of the potential exacerbation of the hypertension on initial dosing. So really, the limiting factor with guanethidine and Guanadrel is their postural hypotension. The last drug on the list is reserpine. Again, reserpine inhibits neuronal uptake. It inhibits vesicular uptake of dopamine and norepinephrine. So it blocks a magnesium ATPase transporter. Ultimately leads to depletion of neurotransmitter. So now you got no neurotransmitter around. Biggest problem with reserpine is it enters the central nervous system, depletes dopamine stores in the central nervous system, and totally mucks things up. Severe mental depression truly limits its use. It can cause a pseudo-Parkinsonian syndrome due to depletion of dopamine in the central nervous system. Turns out it blocks indirect acting sympathomimetics by preventing their uptake as well. But reserpine has been combined with other drugs into a single tablet called Serpacil for hypertension. So it's not a first-line drug, it's not a second-line drug, but when you got two drugs on board and you're not getting the reduction you want, here's another alternative. And so when we do hypertension, we'll talk about all these options. But with these other drugs, B, C, and D, the net result with guanethidine, Guanadrel, and reserpine is depletion of neurotransmitter or reduced neurotransmitter stores. All right. Adverse effects are listed on the next page. You guys should be able to explain all these. So I'm not going to go through it today with you. You should be able to understand why these drugs could cause these kinds of effects. And on Friday, if there are problems, you can ask. But you should be able to explain them all. Or they're just totally weird. All right. The final thing for today is a discussion of glaucoma. One of the things that I have done for you is list the different groups of drugs that are available in glaucoma. You'll notice that there are all kinds of things available. The method is always topical administration. There are some diuretics that could be used orally, but those are really getting down to last choice. So beta blockers can be used. They decrease aqueous secretion. We've got prostaglandins, which increase outflow. Probably the first line drug that's used today, the prostaglandins. There is a combination of a beta blocker with a diuretic, timolol dorzolamide, that can be used, that's widely used. Probably more like number two. The cholinomimetics, which are listed three in the chart, are probably at the bottom of the chart in terms of actual use. But But as you can see, there are a lot of mechanisms by which you can get rid of stuff from the anterior chamber. So wide-angle glaucoma, increase in intraocular pressure, you're doing anything you can to reduce that pressure. So you either decrease production of humor, which is normally on all the time, or you increase its outflow. So it's not just the miotics that are useful, there are other drugs that are useful. And so for right now, you don't have to put a whole lot of energy into this table. But I just wanted to give you the big picture for glaucoma. Okay? Now, the question was raised, what's on the exam? The exam next Wednesday contains all of autonomics and all of basic principles. On Friday, we're supposed to start cardiovascular. I also know that I gave you review questions for autonomics and review questions for basic principles, but you don't have the answers yet for the review questions in autonomics. Sorry, I forgot. But I've got them. So I'll give them to you on Friday. There was a question asked about some of the basic principles ones. Some of the math got messed up in some people's minds. So maybe we can spend a little bit of time on Friday trying to review some of those review questions. So if you'll try to go through those questions, we'll do that. Okay? The material is only out of the two handouts so far. So Friday you'll get another one. The class on Friday, you guys have a noon conference, correct?
Yes.
So it's in Wegg Miller Auditorium. Other questions? Okay, thanks.